So, top chapters, most of them worked. I think that I was able to match names with pictures. I'm going to send this around. I think one picture didn't take. So what I did is I grabbed one from online, your student directory. You may or may not like that. You also may or may not like the picture as taken yesterday, bad hair day, whatnot. Should that be the case, if there's something wrong, if you want to take a new picture, just X out the picture, take a new one, I should be able to manage. If you have a mismatch as far as the name is concerned, X it out, put your name where it belongs. If I misspelled your name, give me a correction on that. Right? So I'm just going to send this whole thing around. You can look at what we got. Yes, every picture was horizontal, so I'm just going to send both around. You look, actually, just put a check mark right next to your picture if everything is in order. And you can find the whole thing on the old web page. So I'm using Moodle, but I still use old technology. Actually, I'm writing my web page in Netscape. Does anybody in this class remember Netscape? Kind of vaguely, that's grandfather's generation, right? So that's a very plain thing. So when you go on Moodle, you see this course webpage, you click on that, that opens up eventually this site, nothing fancy, just a couple of colors to, you know, keep the eyes occupied. And then what you have on top is actually, this is where the pictures are right now, right? So it's a bad camera, the light thing is not going to happen. We don't care too much about that. We just want to have pictures where we can recognize, right? So, on this webpage, since we're on that, also another couple of things. There is materials on here that may be useful for you all. So, for example, and this gives away my age, I'm still using overheads. Anybody remember those old planker things? And so some of them, most of them actually down here. So you click on them, you kind of get the information that I project on the overhead, just some basics. So whenever I pull out an overhead, I will do that today, for example. That's where you can find the information, so you don't need to write everything down frantically. There's ways to access that stuff, right? And also audio, I had mentioned that. So here is where you find the audio. Again, that's only accessible from the Furman network. So you have to be on the Furman network, otherwise you get a 404 error or file not found, something like that. The reason for that is, among other things, believe it or not, there's a couple of right-winger outfits that are trying to listen in and blacklist professors that don't, you know, toe a particular line. Yes, in the 21st century, we still have those idiots out there. And so I don't mind being listed on their side, actually. I think it's a badge of honor. But, you know, I just don't want to have too many headaches with that. So this is where you find the stuff. So if you missed the class, what I suggest is go and see whether you can find materials online. Should I have forgotten to post it, or should I have forgotten? Posting is one thing, the other is to put in links, actually. And on Netscape, that's actually every single time you have to key code that yourself. A lot of work, so I don't do that every day. So in case you're looking for audio, you can't find it, let me know and I'll see whether I can code it for you. I can give you kind of the key. So the file names, the files will all be in the same directory, and you probably can make out the key yourselves. The file name is just going to be RAR323, then year, month, and day, right? And this one's actually off. No, it's not off. Why is it? Is today 15th or 14th? 15th. So then Tuesday was 13th. Yeah. So this one's already off, so I'm going to have to correct that. But that's, you know, for future files, they're going to be on there, so that's like it. And it's an MP3 file. You can just download it onto your MP3 player. Don't even have to convert it and listen to it. Okay. Any questions on that old-fashioned technology stuff, everybody on board, how that works. And then quickly back to Moodle. So this is where you will be finding most of the material. I just yesterday updated or uploaded the schedule. So we all looked at the syllabus and the tentative schedule, right, as is right now. I just put it up. What is in all likelihood going to happen sooner or later is that we're going to be off schedule, that we will change readings, or that we will drop or add, whatever, you know, switch things around. Should I do that, I will announce that in class, and in addition to that, I will recode this one. So strike out on this one means forget about it, and red means pay attention, this is something new, this is something different, right? So that's for those of you, if you miss a class or if it was confusing what I said in class, you always, well, not always, but this is a good place to look before you email me to see what kind of changes there may have been. Everybody on board? Okay. Then one more thing that I forgot to mention on Tuesday. I would like to know that everybody can actually use Moodle. And it's not just that people can access Moodle and get materials off of Moodle, but also actively participate in Moodle. And for that, what I've usually done is I have this forum, Introduce Yourself, and I have that one here. So one way for you to just quickly show me, yeah, I can actually post something on Moodle is to introduce yourself, and similar to what you did on Tuesday. Another way of doing it is, it would be to go to this one, paper topic ideas. We haven't talked much about that. I told you we want decisions quite early. You need to think about that. So there is a forum, paper topic ideas, where you can go share with the class what you're presently thinking about doing, what kind of research project you would like to pursue. And then others can chime in. I think I mentioned this on Tuesday. I would urge and encourage you to find a topic that you're really interested in. Look at the list that I give you on the syllabus, but also think about other alternatives that you're interested in. And we had already a couple out here, I believe, that were going in a different direction. The reason I'm asking for that is it makes everybody's life easier. If you write a paper that your heart is really in and that you have fun doing, that shows in the paper and it will show in the final product. So if I have the choice between reading a paper that was written under duress, that's going to be a painful experience for me. It's not going to be good for you in terms of grade. So everybody is happier if we all find topics that we really love to talk about, right? So think about your hobbies, think about prior exposures, think about interests, and there's always a way to kind of, you know, build on what your strengths are already and what you're interested in, right? So again, my invitation to you all, think, post something, and drop by my office, make an appointment with me, and we can chat about paper possibilities. All right, everybody still awake? It's kind of quiet in here. All right, couple of other technical things that we're going to do. We forgot on Tuesday to do this intro test. I think I'm going to do it briefly. At this point in time, who thinks and knows that they are actually advanced students? I know of 2, 3. Any other advanced candidates? Anybody else in this class who has good exposure to Islam already and thinks that, you know, has taken courses? Any undecideds, or is the rest of the class just saying, ah, I'm going to be a regular student, that's that? Any ambivalence as far as that is concerned? I think I'm going to give the test anyways, just to see whether, okay. So the other thing, homework for today, I had asked you to play the professor. I hope you all brought your graded sheet. So before I collect that, very quickly let's go over that and let's see what you, the professor, found on each of these 4 hypothetical student papers.
So we had papers.
Just quickly see whether I have a copy here that we can put up.
So here we go. We have the source code on the top, and then we have hypothetical students A through D. So let's go through them one by one. Who wants to play professor on student A? And give me your names. One, two. And your name again?
Elena. The entire paper was plagiarism because he didn't even quote the souls, and basically all he did was, all this person, all they did was, like, re-roll whatever that this soul says.
Okay. So, the entire paper, plagiarism in that, well, let's see, it was specific on that one, right? So it's bad, we agree on that.
Sammy, and so there was a, exactly what was just said, a lot of direct copies, like, for instance, the first sentence was exact copy.
Okay.
Certain parts of phrases he would exact copy. He would change like one or two words.
Okay.
But
okay.
It made the writing worse.
Right.
So it was a really productive form.
Okay. So verbatim, right? The ipsissima verba, the very words of the original author being recycled, being stolen, and this student is pretending that's my own genius of wordsmithing here. It's not. And then so it's both words and ideas that are being taken from our source and they're not being acknowledged, right? So in that sense, it's a dual offense, right? Everybody sees that, right? So what would be, how would you fix that? What would you have to do to fix that to make that acceptable? And you are...
Gretchen.
Okay.
And I feel like they just, well, obviously you need to, like, paper B, put a citation in.
Okay.
They have, like, a footnote. But okay. Also, like, you need to, according to, like, claim whose work you're,
okay.
You're getting knowledge.
So according to what we want way of doing it, and then definitely put in a footnote or whatever citation manual you use, different ways, footnote in text citation or whatnot. So that's part of it. So now we're acknowledging that the ideas are actually not ours, but we're referencing the original author on there. And in addition to that, as far as the wordsmithing is concerned, what would we have to do? What are our choices here?
Jordan.
And Jordan.
So I would say to use quotations for select pieces where he wants to use exact lines from the author, but I would take the sentiment or the thought process from the source code and try and change it and put my own opinion.
Okay. So in your own words, in other words, right? So you have the choice. If you think that the author has said it in such gorgeous and beautiful fashion that you could not even dare to, you know, summarize it in your own words, great. Then use the quote, right? But put quotation marks around it to indicate these ain't my words, these are the words of somebody else, right? Or put it in your own words. Are you following? All right. So that's paper A. Paper B? Any take on B? Yes, and your name?
Evelyn.
Evelyn.
Paper B, the student, I thought, did a pretty good job, except there were two things that I underlined that maybe had about four or five words in a row that were directly quoted from, not quoted, but made from the original source.
Okay. So there's still this issue. So on the positive side, you would say, initially, right, the first sentence, an urge toward martyrdom and rigidity in all their beliefs, end quote. So the author is indicating these words in mind, these are Borsten's words, and then with number one in there, that's number one, a footnote, right? So author is now telling us, I got this stuff from Daniel Borsten. So far, so good, right? So that is superior to A, but if you were starting about there, and let's continue that, what's the problem here? Angela.
Alice?
Alice.
He didn't use the exact words, but he stole the ideas. And
So he is still using Borsten's ideas, not his own, and the reader is led to believe, after footnote one, author is talking him herself, so that it's misleading in the sense that I, the professor, assume this is still the brilliancy of student B, whereas in effect, this is the Borsten. You are seeing that? In that sense, it's misleading. So we want to fix that. If we wanted to fix that, how would we fix that? What we do? Unfixable, trash the paper? No.
You, Elaine, you say, like, according to Bolston, like, Bolston expands on this idea by saying...
So indicate in some fashion what follows is still Borsten stuff. So you could say, according to Borsten, one way, or add another footnote later on, right? But this is still Borsten, but somehow indicate it's not me who is talking here, the student, but this is still Borsten talking. I'm just rephrasing his ideas. Everybody understand? Okay. All right, paper C. Anybody want to take on paper C? Let's pull the paper C up so we can actually. Yes, and your name?
Alexis.
Alexis.
And I kind of just said that they did a bad job at paraphrasing, I guess.
Okay.
Because I guess it's less just taking direct stuff from it, but they could have changed a few words around.
Okay.
But so if they were going to paraphrase, they'd do a little better and still cite.
Okay.
And even though. Okay.
So it's
kind of took it.
The paraphrasing is not pretty or beautiful. Okay, so I take it. Grade off or something like that. There's still a little bit of wordage that is very similar to that, but most importantly, that's what you said last second.
They still need to cite.
Exactly. Still make reference. This is not my idea. This is Borsten's idea, right? So either according to Borsten or at the end of it in a parenthetical citation or footnote referencing Borsten, from whom we get this idea. Everybody understand? Okay. And then finally, paper D. Anybody find... Anybody have beef with D?
Lauren?
Lauren, yes.
He stated Borsten's name in it, but he still didn't give, like, a proper citation.
Okay. So you could find fault with that. At least he's acknowledging Borsten, right? Well, and then, you know, I probably didn't give you the bibliography was cited or something like that. So that is not 100% on target. Overall, I think everybody in this class can agree that out of the various papers, D is the least problematic. But if you want to be nitpicky, and some of us want to be that way, that would be one, right? So proper citation, full citation is important. And then if you want to be really nitpicky, there's still one phrase in there, and it is an urge toward martyrdom, right? It's a very pregnant phrase. And so if you really wanted to pay close attention, you would make sure to indicate that this particular phrase is not your own, that you actually get that from Borsten.
Also, I found,
And your name?
Kelsey.
Kelsey.
The rigid in all their beliefs is really similar to rigidity in all their beliefs.
Okay. So it's very close, right? It's borrowed. It's not really in your own words. It's uncomfortably close to the original wording,
okay,
right?
No,
there's
a third one, too.
A third one?
The last part where it says away from the community and
okay.
More to
okay. So they're, again, uncomfortably close to, right? So you want to shy away from that. Overall speaking, I think everybody is in agreement that the last one is not quite as obnoxious as the others. But, you know, if you pay close attention, even that one. So one wants to be very careful with that. Right? Okay. Any questions on that? If not, I suggest put your name on the piece and then send it up front. I'm just going to hold on to them. I'm going to grade them. I'm going to quickly fly over them. Don't expect them back. This is not a graded exam or anything like that. This is just for my own reference. So should something transpire at the end of the semester, we can look at this again and we can see whether you did or did not understand proper citation. so that's kind of the use of this. And you'll all understand.
All right. On to some other technical stuff. Let's see.
Actually, let's save the intro test for later. Let's get a little bit into the subject matter. So, the class that we are talking, that we're doing here, has two major subject matters on it, right? One of them is Islam, and the other one is gender, women, what have you. So let's start with Islam. Starting off with very basic observations, and this is where some of the folks that have had previous exposure would probably be a little bit bored, but that's all right. Repetition is the mother of all learning. So, religious tradition we're going to be talking about is Islam. The term itself, Arabic, from a root word salama, to submit. So Islam is the act of submission. Submission to who or what? Submission to the one true God. A person who so does is called a Muslim. And what you're going to see is that these are etymologically related and actually from the same root. When you look closely at it, the SLM in here is also in here, right? So the SLM, triliteral root in Arabic, actually related to a Hebrew word. What kind of Hebrew word do we know that has an S sound, an L sound, and an M sound? This is what it looks like. Anybody?
Shalom.
Shalom, peace, right? So what does Islam, Muslim, shalom, peace have to do with each other? A broad understanding. This is now kind of, you know, drawing bridges. If everybody submits to the same will, then they ain't going to be strife no longer. There's going to be peace, right? So that's kind of the broader. Next lesson. Okay. So that's what we're talking about. A huge religious tradition, a second largest in the world, if you just taxonomize them according to, you know, the basic differentiations. The estimation is anywhere from 1.2 to 1.6 billion Muslims worldwide. And there's a number of understandings that are not really fully correct understandings, misunderstandings about this religious tradition. We're going to get, we're going to come across a great number of those over the term. One big one is that it's a religion that is predominantly Arab. Yes, many Arabs are Muslim. Not all Arabs are Muslim, and no, Arabs are not the majority of the religious tradition. The majority is actually further east, right? So we can look a little bit at, and every single representation of the religious tradition as far as population is concerned is going to be problematic. So let's start off with an easy one. This is a map, religious, the Atlas of Religions, I think is the title. And it color codes the majority regions, right? But in the way that it represents this religious tradition that we're talking about, there is a number of distortions. And some of them you can guess yourself. What are some of the distortions when you look at religion just as a question of where the majority is? In what ways do you think may that be an accurate reflection of reality, and in what ways may that actually be unhelpful? What does it hide? If you just pay attention to majorities, what does it hide? That's a basic, straightforward question. That's a no-brainer. It hides the minorities, right? So it just goes, the very second that a particular territory is 51%, it hides 49% of the people, right? So it's much more complicated than that. Of course, Muslims are not limited to these regions. I think a fun fact that we heard on Tuesday, somebody shared fun facts about, was it India? No, about...
Okay, so
where's India? India is up here, right? Lots of Muslims there. This map wouldn't tell you that there's Muslims there, right? So in that sense, distorted. And that goes for other regions as well. That's one way. Maps in general are distorted, or
where almost every single map is distorted. Anybody know anything about distortion in maps? What's the problem with two-dimensional maps? Yes, and names again, please.
Well, maps used to actually portray Europe as being larger than the continent.
Okay. So how that happened? Well, was it just that Europeans thought, let's beat them, you know, we just make our thing look bigger. And your name?
SK.
Yes.
The author, the purpose that it's trying to serve is created, you know, it's presented by the map, so it serves a certain purpose.
Okay, so there's always ideology. Everything is political. So in that sense, right?
When you look at it, at least one thing is like in the center, like a few places are in the center, versus like as a row of everything is in the center.
So you always have to pick, right? It's a three-dimensional round thing, and you have to pick your middle, right? And so in that sense, you could... we are picking... Well, Europe, somebody said... You said... No, somebody said Europe. We're picking Europe, right? Of course, Europe is the center of attention, right? You could pick something else, right? Which then would also define where's east and where's west, right? The east is east of somebody, but also the west of somebody else, right? So in our very vocab, we have already ingrained ideology, right? And then, of course, there is the basic mathematical question and problem of a spherical, the Earth is round, we all know that by now, right? Spherical object being projected on a two-dimensional surface. Think summer. Think beach ball, and think how do you get the beach ball to become a rectangular surface. You can do it with an iron, right? But something's got to give, right? So you have to stretch something, because, well, what do you have to stretch and what do you have to squeeze to get there? Beach ball. Take scissors, imagine your beach ball, now imagine you have scissors, chop it up, and then try to flatten it.
Susanna? Well, because of that, the proportions of the countries are all off relative to one another.
So proportions are off, right? Which means in practical terms that the map that we have here in front of us, mercatorial projection, gives us what problems? What does it squeeze and what does it stretch? Anybody know?
Stretch the top and squeeze the
exactly. Stretches here, right? Somewhere down here, the South Pole. The South Pole is a point. On this one, the South Pole is long as the equator, right? The equator is huge, right? If you want to walk around the equator and swim, it takes you a long time. If you want to visit Santa Claus and walk around his house, that's a minute walk, right? You see the difference? But it appears as if this and that is all the same length. It's not, right? So in practical terms, that means that northerly and far southerly regions get stretched and the middle gets squeezed, right? That is to say, proportionally, this is actually much bigger and proportionally, this is much smaller. So when you look in the political aspect that you mentioned, when you look at this thing pre-89, right? What used to be the Soviet Union. Big, scary, right? Look at them Soviets and all of their land, right? They are big and scary. You following, right? Whereas if you projected this proportionally, not really that big, not really that scary, right? So there are vested interests, ideological interests in cartography as well. And there's different ways to project them. So here we have some of those that try to take account of that. So one way you can do is these, you know, these maps that kind of do a little bit of that. Of course, they have other problems. And then you have various ways of doing this. I think this is at the mercatorial. So there's various ways. I'm just, you know, for you to think about it. Now, we are, though, not interested in square mileage, right? How many square miles for Islam versus how many square miles for Judaism. We're interested in people. Right? So when you go the people route, you can project that in something like this. Okay? So this is now an attempt to take into consideration not square mileage, although that's also somewhere in there, but population density as well. How many people do we have living in a particular area of the world that in the majority are this, that, or the other distribution? There's still distortion in there. The minority problem is not solved here. But this makes it represents a little bit more of the adherence. You see what this map is trying to do. Everybody on board? We can recognize what's this here? What is this here? The Americas, right? Africa, Europe, and this is Asia, right? Okay. So, this is a different way of looking at our religions. When you compare this one with this one, what jumps out at you? What are some of the differences that you notice? So here is mercatorial, and here is the population density.
India is a lot bigger.
India, look at India, right? Blue, look at it here. Look at it here. Puny, tiny, little, right? Squeezed. Mm-hmm. Why is it squeezed here? For a number of reasons, right? It's actually in the equatorial region. That's part of the mercatorial projection, right? So territory-wise, well, you have to squeeze the stuff to get it onto a flat surface. But then also population density in there, right? So back to, of course, it still hides the fact that there's a lot of Muslims living here. Right? It's coded here as Hindus, but it gives away that there's other stuff going on as well. Right? So India is bigger. Other observations. What else is changing? Here again, big, bad, evil. Yes?
Sammy, the Americas are all one color and they're a lot smaller.
Okay, so the Americas actually are getting a little bit smaller, right? Our population density is not really all that impressive, right? So that's a difference. Now talking about the US of A, let's talk about our former enemy. Look at big bad Russia over here. Can you find Russia? Somewhere squeezed up there, right? Not particularly big. Okay, it's still a lot of territory, but not particularly big. Population density also very low. And then, what else? Red, you see that? Kind of becoming a little bit bigger, getting more into focus. And then look all the way to your right. There's greenery, right? There's some greenery here, as far as Indonesia and Malaysia is concerned, but it really is kind of disappearing there in the oceans, right? It's not really catching your attention. But when you look at it closely, there's a lot of Muslims living in Indonesia. Indonesia is the most populous Muslim majority country in the world. Right? That big, right? Okay, so those are some of the things to keep in mind while we study. So what we're talking about then is a religious tradition that is highly variegated, spread all over the globe. And of course, again, this one hides other facts as well. We have majority populations here, and then we have kind of the 50-50 population in parts of Africa. Of course, that doesn't mean that we don't have Muslims anywhere else, right? As far as India is concerned, again, huge Muslim population in India, but then also Muslim populations in other parts of the world, Europe, just coming into the news again, right? And then also Muslim populations in the Americas. Right, right now, big contest between Judaism and Islam, who is second, right? So there's different number games being played by different people as to whether Muslims by now outnumber Jews or vice versa. And you can imagine that that is a highly politically charged debate going on as well. Okay, so that as a first stab at the religious tradition, that gives you somewhat of a heads up that the religious tradition that we are studying is a highly complex religious tradition, though while it shares the name, any simplistic assertion, Islam this, Islam that, is going to be ludicrous. It's much more complicated than that. There's this old joke about Judaism, where there's two Jews in a room, there's three opinions, and the same goes for Islam, right? That there's a lot of different attitudes toward the religious tradition. Now, to get our hands on that, we're going to talk about various biases over the next couple of weeks. And we have to remember that the study of the religious tradition by outsiders cannot but be a biased approach. There is no objective outside stand that you can take. There is no objective way of representation. We always already come with our own baggage. And I think we had done a little bit of... Have we talked about the seven dimensions on Tuesday? A tad bit toward the end of class, I think, right? So one of the problems that everybody faces who studies religion or studies anything, I would say, is that we always come from particular perspectives and situatednesses that impact the way that we perceive the world. In our context, and I'm oversimplifying here in Oblast fashion, that means that the majority of folks in this class, the majority of folks growing up in a quote-unquote, and that's of course overgeneralized too, Western context, perceive religion as a particular thing and a particular type of entity. Oftentimes in Western Christian and particularly Protestant Christian environments, religion is primarily seen as an issue of faith. Belief is what determines religion, right? And that is a Protestant perspective, going back to Martin Luther's sola fidei, faith only, that's really what determines what religious entities are, or what religion means. And that may be true for certain types of Protestantism, but when you only focus on that one aspect of religion, you lose sight of so many other dimensions, of so many other ways in which religion works and expresses itself. And so comparativists, among them the most famous one, Nguyen Smart, in the 80s, early 90s of last century, comes up with another way of thinking about religion. It's not necessarily defining religion, that's in itself a problematic proposition. But he says that instead of just paying attention to faith and belief, that is to say, what he would call the doctrinal or philosophical dimension, you ought to also pay attention to other stuff that is going on in religious traditions to really understand what religion is. Right? And so he proposes there are seven different dimensions. It's not just about faith, but it is also about ritual. It is about the emotional and experiential side of religion. It's about stories. Oftentimes it's about law, and it's about social and institutional ones. I think that this is a straightforward shot, but just to flesh it out a little bit, let's think about religious traditions that we are familiar with. If you want your own or others of your friends or what you've read about, and let's get a sampling of each of these so we all know what we're talking about, because we're going to use this system a number of times throughout the term, just to broaden our perspective on what religion is. So, who can think of a practice or a ritual in a religious tradition? So, two questions. Who can think about it? Give me a sample. And then also, of course, we are studying religion in academic context. So once we have samples, i.e. we have data, we in academia, of course, also want to know what tools to use to appreciate and understand, comprehend, right? So what's the data, right? And what's the academic department on Furman campus that I need to go to get an appreciation, to understand what's going on? You are following my question here? Okay, so let's do that. Who wants to grab an example?
I can try. I recently took a class with
Dr. Turner, and we talked about the Hopi.
Okay.
So the Hopi is an Indian religion, Native American. So the first, like, practical and ritual would be, like, the Kachina dances, where they do dances to, like, for, you know, to thank their gods, but also to, like, corn is really big in their society, so for corn... Like the experiment. Do you want me to go through all of them?
No, just so there's one example, right?
Oh, okay.
So let's travel to Hopi Reservation in our minds, and so we're looking at it. Oh, it's so pretty, right? Mm-hmm. Now, next thing for us in academia is not just to appreciate the beauty of it, but also to, in a sense, get a comprehension from a critical perspective, right? So what department on Fermi campus, what discipline, what I need to consult with to make sense of what's going on, the pretty stuff that I just saw on the Hopi Reservation. What's the discipline to appreciate and understand rituals such as a Hopi corn dance?
History.
Okay, history would be one way you could approach it from a historical critical perspective. How have dances looked 100 years ago, if we have footage of that? What has changed? So that would be one of them. What other disciplines to study ritual?
Anthropology.
Anthropology. Okay, so anthropology, that study of human society. So somewhere in there. And of course, always us folks in religion, right? We do it all. We are just so fascinating. We are a multidisciplinary enterprise. Okay, so anthropology and or the historical aspects of history. Experiential, emotional aspect of a dimension of religion. Sampling of that one, and who would you go to? Religious experiences. Anybody have a sample for me?
So, Suzanne.
Sure.
So, like, speaking in tongues.
Okay, speaking in tongues. So you go out to Appalachia, and you go to one of them churches there, and
yeah.
People are just getting out of themselves and doing all kinds of interesting things. So, again, fun experience or scary experience. But then, who do you go to analyze that? What's the department? What's the discipline that you may want to consult with?
You could consult, well, the linguistic department.
Okay, so as far as the tongues is concerned, right, you could see whether it actually makes sense, what kind of language are they speaking here. But as far as the experience itself is concerned, the emotional aspect?
Lauren, I guess you could say the psychology.
Psychology, right. Go with the psychology and see what kind of psychological state are these folks in, right? And, you know, what does it say? Analyze that, right? Narrative mythic, an example, and the discipline. Stories. Every religious tradition is telling stories. They may be true stories, that is to say, historically grounded stories. They may be non-verifiable stories. They may have a mythic quality to it. And you?
Kelsey. In Buddhism, I feel like there's a pretty large emphasis on the story of the Buddha's life and
okay.
His journey toward
Exactly. His journey toward enlightenment, right? That's... One of the basic ones, four sites that he sees, etc., etc. So that's the story itself, so that would be narrative mythic. Who'd you go to make sense of those stories?
Maybe a historian if you're trying
okay.
to.
Okay, so you want to give more jobs to the historian, so that would be one way, particularly with historical narratives.
The classics department?
Classics department would be another one with antique classical texts. English department, literature. What they all have somewhat in common is the question of literature, right? What kind of genre are we talking about when we talk about these narratives? What kind of text is it? And texts themselves have their own sciences to them. That is to say, they have mechanisms by which, things are conveyed. And so they are tools to dissect texts in certain fashion, right? So, for example, to bring it closer to home, the narrative of the Garden of Eden, according to biblical accounts, right? So here we have a talking animal, right? When you go to a literature department and you have a story where animals talk, what kind of story, what kind of genre is that?
Fiction.
So what?
Fiction.
Fiction, fable, aesop, right?
So there are ways to look at stories with, in which animals talk. They have certain mechanisms, and we can analyze that. You following? Okay. Doctrinal philosophical example in our department. Well, the department is kind of a no-brainer. Example of philosophical or doctrinal dimension of religion.
Confessions
of Augustine, you mean, right? So as long as they contain therein theological truth, right? So, yes. So in that sense, very much so. Other doctrines, the doctrine of the Trinity, right? The doctrine of monotheism. There's one God out there. Or polytheism. The doctrine of Islam, of Muhammad's prophethood, right? So those basic doctrines and philosophical systems. God, the creator, who does this? And, is this God an omnipotent God? What does it mean when somebody says it's an omnipotent God? Right? How do these various doctrines logically cohere with each other? Are they contradictory? Those kinds of questions, right? So we go over to the philosophy department, or we had a theology department. Those would be the departments that study coherence, logic in a particular thing, in a particular system of meaning. You all following? Kind of quiet. Ethical, legal, an example, and who do we go to?
Ten Commandments,
for example, right? So, thou shalt and thou shalt not. So we have ethical, legal systems in religious traditions. We're going to see quote-unquote Islamic law that comes across Sharia. We're going to see how that is. And then again, how do we study law? Who do we consult when we study law?
Political
science, because they do the pre-law here, right? So, you know, they can look at legal systems, are they coherent, etc., etc. Social institutional examples of that. And who do we consult? Each religious tradition has some type of institutionalization, has some type of layering, and you need
Jordan. Maybe the forming of the church.
Okay, so the forming of the church and the church itself as an institution, or different types of institutions within the church. Hierarchy, pope, archbishop, bishop, what have you, right? And then the various questions that you can ask about these institutions for our course, very interesting, the role of gender, right? Is there egalitarian structures in societies of religion, in institutions of religion? Is there not? Of course, that's one that is, you know, interesting to raise. Who do we go to better make sense of social and institutional realities? That's also almost a no-brainer, because you just start with the first three letters here. Sociology, right? They study social systems, right? And then lastly, material. Material, just stuff. Religious stuff. For example, what kind of religious stuff? For example, on campus, do we have any religious stuff flying around anywhere on campus?
Temple.
So that temple over there on the hill, right? Or that other temple, highest point on Furman campus, Daniel Chapel, right? Cross on top, that's all stuff, right? So with temple and chapel, we're talking architecture, because inside there's religious stuff, such as banners, and in other religious traditions, other religious gadgets, right? Kachina dolls, right? Who do we go to analyze stuff? Okay, so historians, they get lots of jobs from us, right? We subcontract to them. But as far as that particular type of stuff is concerned, so we can look at the temple, we can look at that temple, i.e. Daniel Chapel, or the stuff inside. You can look at banners, we can look at, what else do they have there? Well, actually, for a Catholic Mass, they have somewhere hidden away, right? The chalice, pretty fancy, I assume, right? Gold and whatnot.
So golden chalices and banners and what have you. Who can help us make sense of those?
Religion
always, religion always, history always, art, right? Religious art, calligraphy, what have you. Much of that, not all of it, but much of that through art or art history. They can analyze how does this develop, what does it say, what's going on with all. You all following? Okay. So that is to say that not only is what we're doing here in this class hugely complicated in terms of the population that we need to keep in mind, it's vast, and it's lots of different regions of the world. So you can expect already a huge diversity from there. But we also need to keep in view various dimensions. That is to say, there is not just a lot of people that we are studying, but of those people, we are studying various dimensions that find expressions in their life, in their culture, in their history. Right? So it's a vast and huge undertaking, what we're doing here. Because that's only part of the story. Because in addition to that, we now also want to pay attention to gender issues. Right? And gender issues do find their expression in a number of these. And we're going to see that, right? So that the experiences, rituals, stories being told, all of these have gender dimensions to them. You're going to see that over and over again, right? So we make it even more messy and more unmanageable. So in other words, we will not be bored over the next couple of weeks. There is lots and lots of stuff to talk about. Okay. So much on the religion aspect, and now over to the gender aspect. And for that, I had asked you to read a couple of pieces. So Gerda Lerner's is just kind of a basic intro. I don't think we need to pay too much attention to that. But we also read Jordan Wallof Scott. And this is, of course, a somewhat dated piece, but it is an important piece that, again, will help us to shorten our skills and tools of understanding a little bit, to think critically about what we're doing. And so let's just take a few minutes to think about Scott. Again, dense, very dense article. This is close to graduate school material, but we can manage at least some of the basics, right? What's Scott trying to do here? What's Scott's basic points? What's going on? Gretchen.
He's trying to break down the purpose of gender and what gender entails.
Okay. So what gender entails and the purpose of gender.
Suzanne. Establishing gender as a social construction.
Okay. So that's a very important point, right? What does she mean, and what do others mean when they talk about gender as a social construction?
The differentiation between sex, or like the physical differences between male and female, and then gender, so masculinity and femininity.
Okay. As a social construct. So one is a biological given, oftentimes, not always. But the other one is social construction onto that, right? It's not a given, it's not natural, but it is, it's made up, right? We are making things up. That is to say, of course, they have a long history, gender has a long history, but it is not something that is naturally, it didn't fall from heaven or anything like that. It changes, right? So that's a very important point. Others.
Use of the word gender to sort of replace women in a way, so that it wasn't as politically daunting as the word woman.
Okay. So there's this somewhat political approach notion in there, right? That gender not only that it replaces women, but that it actually emphasizes the fact that it's not just about women, but it's relational, right? Whatever we say about women, we're also saying something about men. So in that sense, it's more inclusive. So those are important notions. What I want us to, and she is going through various approaches, historical approaches, that we, for those of you who are interested in more theory, great. I just want to get the basic gist out of it, and the gist you find, her definition as gender as a category of historical analysis. So
didn't just fall down from heaven, and it's not just a descriptive enterprise, but by looking at gender, we can also come to a deeper understanding and analysis of society at large. It can be used as a tool. And particularly, she is developing her own definition with subsets on page 1067. Where I think, for me, the meat of the matter is, right? If you go to that page, the full paragraph beginning in the middle, the definition rests on integral connection between two propositions. One, gender is a constitutive element of social relationships based on perceived differences between sexes. So they are very important. That's just pointed out. Sex, gender, different things. It's a constitutive element of social relationships based on perceived differences between the sexes. And, that's point two, gender's primary way of signifying relationships of power. So for here it's very important to understand whether there's differences here, but those differences are also functions of power, associated with power. And then she comes up with four interrelated elements in this construction and reproduction of gender. And that's what we're going to be playing with for the next couple of weeks. And we can think in a second how these actually may interrelate with the seven dimensions of religion that we've talked about. So, four interrelated elements are... quickly get my not that one. Okay. Four interrelated elements. First off, culturally available symbols invoking multiple representations that are often contradictory, and they then lead into normative concepts that are setting forth interpretations of these meaningful symbols, and those interpretations take place in politics, social institutions, and organizations. And all of that is leading into subjective identity, so those four interrelated elements taken together. And then the second aspect of her definition, gender is primary way of signifying relationships of power. So all of that very abstract and theoretical, and I thought it would be fun to actually bring this home by analyzing our own institution, FU. Furman University and gender and ideology, and replicating in a sense the larger universe in some fashion. Can we think of examples that would flesh out a little bit of this abstract definition of gender? That is to say, on Furman campus, in your Furman experience, what kind of symbols can you think about that evoke gender? And then how do the symbols run into normative concepts, into politics, social institutions, and then lastly, a negative, this and this, right?
The bell tower.
Okay, so bell tower, make an observation on that as a symbol, and if you can, run it through Scott's.
Okay, I'll try. It's the main phallic symbol of Furman's campus.
So we have phallus, right?
I haven't gotten further than that,
actually. Okay. So bell tower is one possible candidate. If we think about symbols, of course, symbols is very broad, right? If you think about symbols in more inclusive fashion, what other symbols are there? Well, actually, one of them, let's try this one, alma mater. Anybody memorize the text of the Alma Mater. How many of you are singing it at a time with gusto when we have convocation?
No, we're just not paying attention. Is that what it is? Let me just quickly bring the Alma Mater up for you. Maybe what's come up there is the Alma Mater. Anyone can read that? People sitting close should be able to read that. The mountain city is her home. A mountain river laves her feet. And from far coasts her children come and crown her brow with flowers sweet. And neath her shade they rest secure and drink from wisdom's fountain pure. Then rally loyal sons and true for our dear Alma Mater. Symbol in a certain way. Alma Mater, of course, mother, right? Your institution is a mother. Anybody want to take any of that? Let's go back to our symbols here. Let's think about this. Symbols, normative concepts.
So if the Alma Mater is seen as this overarching ideal that sort of encompasses what Fermi is all about, mm-hmm. and mothers presented, mothers are women who are, mm-hmm. tend to be compassionate and caring.
Okay. Okay.
And that's been, you know, over the past centuries. That's been
right. So that's coming, so the normative concept for mothers as these kind of forgiving, you know, all-encompassing. And it's interesting, of course, it's only sons. Now, this is, of course, the text was written, I think, before the two colleges joined, right? So there's historical roots in there. Other symbols. Let's go symbol ritual. How many of you participated in My Tidings? Okay. Is that a symbol or is it something else? We'll probably go somewhere down here. Institution, to a certain extent, right? What's the My Tie Dance all about? It's a little bit more generic, right? Who has not participated? Who doesn't know what My Tie Dance is? Somebody want to throw out the quick My Tie Dance 101?
Steal a tie and then they're paired together. I don't know, it's changed over the years to try and make it less gendered, actually.
Oh, okay.
Try and make it more green oriented.
Okay. So how did it...
I mean, so when I first knew it, it was like the girls in your sister hall get just a random color tie. If you get that same color tie, you're paired up with that group.
Okay. So it's not no longer as awkward that you actually
start with that person. In the past, that's what it was. But yeah. Now it's...
Yeah, okay. So now it's not. It was more like the girl actually takes the tie and you find your secret blind date.
Okay. And, you know, so that's a practice, so you can go back from this. So in a sense, it's an institutionalized practice that has been around for not that long. If I understand it correctly, it was started in the 80s. That in itself is an interesting fact. But it isn't from the 50s, right, as you would probably think it to be from. So, you know, what's going on there, right? So, you know, those kind of questions that you can throw at ourselves. So, what kind of normative concepts are expressed in the Mai Tai dance of the 80s or of the 2010s? What implicit messages do you receive on one of the first days on Fermi campus? You just come out out of high school, and you're being now shown how things work at Fermi, right?
And I guess like find a guy and that kind of a thing.
Okay, okay.
Go find a relationship.
Okay. So first of all, find a guy, right? It's heteronormativity, right? So that one is in there. And then a valorization
of that type of relationship. You may say, if you want to do an uncharitable reading over other types of relationship that may be beneficial in an academic setting. Right? So there are certain things going on there. So that's what Scott is talking about. Of course, not for, well, you can play this with Fermi, you can play it somewhere else. And then, you know, all of these things, how do they produce you? And how do you, in turn, reproduce those structures for the next generation, right? And what changes and what doesn't change, you know? How much do we fall into certain types of normativity, consciously or unconsciously, and then what kinds of ways are there to break out of identity, to challenge structures?
So, like, the varying gender ratios in different majors?
Okay.
Like, if you look at an outcoming business class, it'll be mostly male.
Right, right.
Like, my history classes are mostly, like, divided half and half.
Right.
While my philosophy are mostly female.
Okay. Education department? Anybody in the education department? That would be another one. So you can look at it from a major perspective. You can also look at it from a faculty perspective. You can look at what departments have actually balance between, male and female professors and which ones don't, and why is that. Lots of interesting questions you can ask. As far as symbols are concerned, another one, you're going to be back. As far as symbols are concerned, think about the campus in large. Think about mascots. So we have the bell tower, right? That's one. The paladin, right? A medieval knight who was beaten up Muslims, right? That's our mascot. So there's now two in there, right? So as far as gender questions are concerned and as far as religion questions are concerned, going hand in hand, that's what medieval knights in the Crusades did. Fight the infidel, right? That's our hero. You can think of other symbols in more indirect ways. What kind of ideology, including gendered ideology, do you get fed, for example, through architecture on this campus? One quick one, and I may just ruin it for you every single time you're going to be walking by the place. You may think about it differently now. Main entrance to Furman Hall, right? You all know the grand staircase that goes up. What kind of ideology is in there? What does it evoke for you? You don't know where you're at, right? You're from Mars, out of town, and you've entered that place, and you're just staying there. You haven't looked at any signs. Where do you think you were at? Do you think you're at college when you're standing there? Grand piano, flowers, two porcelain birds on a piano, supported by books, right? They're staying on the books, right? So the message here is books are for inspiration. To prop up our pretty birds. I'm being really mean right now. Grand staircase, grand piano as decoration, big pictures, other side of the couch. If you didn't know this is a college, what would you think that room means?
Like a home or like some sort of like living room area?
Okay, living room area. And then, but it's a little bit too grand to be a real living room, right? It's not, it doesn't have the coziness. What kind of ideology is grand piano? How many of us have grand pianos at home? Not too many folks, okay. But do we play with ours?
Yes.
Yes, good. Is that one being played with?
No.
Seldom.
Not after 9
p.m. Not allowed after 9 p.m.?
Yeah.
Okay. And before 9 p.m., you can't because it's class meeting, right? So it's. So grand piano as decoration. Where do you see grand piano as decoration? What other contexts may you see that?
In Wake Forest. They have one in every dorm.
Okay. As decoration or to
play? As decoration.
As decoration. Okay. What kind of ideology is...
Like, money, wealth.
It's not your blue-collar worker who's going to have one of them in their double-wide mobile home, right? So there's wealth here. We got money, man. We got so much money, we actually can have piano standing there just catching dust. Sorry, I'm overdoing it here. I'm trying to be somewhat intentionally half offensive without really offending. For us to think, right? So we have that in here, grand piano, and then we have the porcelain birds and portraits. What kind of institution, what kind of place does it evoke? Brainscape?
Yeah, country club.
Country club, that's kind of in there, so that wealth notion is in there, right? And then in terms of, so the age that a college is shooting for is actually 18 to 22-year-olds, right? How many of you can well relate to that antique furniture there as an 18 or 32-year-old? Is that kind of your age group that is being addressed here, that is being welcomed, that is being said, look, so IKEA furniture, that's probably yours generation, right? You know, put some IKEA there, we know we're at home. So who then is being addressed?
Our parents.
Parents, or even one generation further, right? And I'm cruel doing this, I'm still going to do it. Everything is now my going, I think, retirement home. Right? It has this feel to it, right? It's not right. So, and that just on ideology, and then you can kind of think about gender. Is that space? And there's just one of many spaces you can think about, right? Does that also say something about gender normativity? There's two portraits in there, I think. I actually have to revisit that, right? There's a guy on one side, I think a female on the other side. Is this about heteronormativity again? What is going on? So, back to this stuff. So culturally available symbols, then in a very broad sense, right? You can think, and you can look at a lot of things that on some level are symbols. That on some level are speaking, are sending a message. Sometimes consciously, sometimes not so consciously. I don't think that anybody who designed that space had in mind, you know, let's make sure that young folks really feel awkward when they walk. That wasn't the intention. But there is something that is ingrained that you can kind of unpack if you look closely at it. Right? And you can do that with lots of things. And so you can play with Furman, spaces that you go to, look around, see what kind of messages are being given, intentionally or unintentionally. And we're going to do a lot of that stuff with various materials in Islam. So we're going to look at texts. We're going to start out, we're going to do a little bit more on perceptions, excuse me, on next week, Tuesday. I have a couple of readings on that. And then we're going to get into various texts. So, I'm a historian, I out myself as such. We're going to do a historical approach to look at ancient classical texts. Okay. Any questions? So, homework for next week, the reading as indicated, and then please either on the paper topic forum. Or just on the introduction topic, just one line or so I know that you actually can post. And then I'll see you all next week.